WNYC Studios is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, where hundreds of researchers make new discoveries inspired by the work of previous Dana-Farber scientists. Learn more about their momentum at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, just in from London via the AP. The UK Prime Minister David Cameron says he is working on plans for a no-fly zone over Libya that could involve military, even perhaps from the United States. We'll find out, perhaps from our next guest, who is especially well-placed to explain the situation in the Middle East. New York Times correspondent Neil McFarquhar grew up in Libya. He is now the Times correspondent at the UN, which is the new focal point of action to stop Gaddafi's massacres, including the possible imposition of a no-fly zone. We might even see the U.S. military drawn into this. And McFarquhar published a book 2 years ago that was about reform movements in the region just before they started being taken seriously. He had the front page story in the Sunday Times on the vacuum after Gaddafi, as it's called. And his book is called The Media Relations Department of Hezbollah Wishes You a Happy Birthday, Unexpected Encounters in the Changing Middle East. So, Neil McFarquhar, welcome back to WNYC. Hi.
Hey, great to be here from Cairo.
You're in Cairo today watching events from there in Libya. Let me get your immediate reaction to this story just coming over now about the UK working on plans for a no-fly zone over Libya, according to David Cameron. What do you think the likelihood is of that, and who would enforce a no-fly zone?
I think that's the problem in a lot of this intervention, is exactly sort of coordinating, who's going to take on the military aspects of it. I mean, it has been done in the past in Iraq, in the north of Iraq and the south of Iraq. And, you know, there were U.S. Airplanes flying off aircraft carriers from the Persian Gulf that enforced it. But the Egyptians, in this case, have already sort of stated their objection to any kind of military intervention next door. And, kind of begs the question, there are, of course, still flights going in there, taking out refugees, et cetera. And also, some of the fighter planes that Gaddafi is apparently sent against Benghazi, or the eastern part of the breakaway part of the country, ditched their planes rather than carry out their orders to bomb. So it seems like, I guess I'd have to hear more about why they think this will be effective. And I think a lot of governments would, too, before they would support it.
You're the UN Bureau Chief for the Times. Would this set some kind of precedent under the theory of the responsibility to protect? In other words, that the UN could be used to enforce human rights within a country, not just intervene in conflicts between countries?
I have to confess I'm a little bit removed from the argument since I'm in Cairo and I haven't been at the UN now for a week. But I think generally the state of responsibility for protect, it's been about a two-decade argument, right, and everybody kind of the idea, but nobody quite has come up with how you actually implement it. And it was discussed in Darfur, and it was discussed, I mean, the closest they got to doing it was after the tsunami hit Myanmar or Burma, whichever name you use, and they sort of felt like the government wasn't really doing enough to help the Burmese citizens that were so devastated by that, and they wanted to intervene, and the Burmese said no in certain terms they do it. So, and they didn't go in, and in the end, they brought some NGOs in, and it worked out for the civilians. But that's the problem, is like, who's going to deploy the forces if the country involved want it, because then it becomes an invasion, and the whole peacekeeping force idea, of course, is that you have a peace to keep, and because most countries don't want to insert their soldiers into two sides in a civil war.
Right.
So who would send them in is kind of an issue.
Would you rule out the possibility that U.S. planes might be involved in enforcing some kind of a no-fly zone, or the U.S. military in any other way during this crisis?
I don't know what the American public's appetite is for in the Middle East and Muslim world after Iraq and Afghanistan. I mean, there's a huge amount of sympathy, of course, for fighting for their freedom. So maybe the American public is ready for it, and there is a precedent in that, you know, the pilots who enforced the no-fly zone did it without American casualties, really. They just, you know, flew high patrols over. So maybe to that extent, yes. But I think that, you know, the whole part of these revolutions has been that, you know, the people, we want peaceful change, and it's these sort of public demonstrations, whereas the government has been saying all this is being engineered by foreigners, it's a foreign plot. And I think once you get American soldiers involved, it sort of adds ammunition to the government that this is all something being orchestrated from the outside rather than, you know, a popular uprising against years.
Yes.
Of autocratic rule.
And a little bit more on that coming in now from the AP. From London, Prime Minister David Cameron says Britain is working with its allies on a plan to establish a military no-fly zone over Libya. Cameron did not say whether that meant that the UK or its allies were moving to ban Libyan aircraft from flying immediately or simply making plans in case the situation there escalated, but he told British lawmakers that he did not in any way rule out the use of military force. So that, the latest on that. Neil McFarquhar, my guest on WNYC, New York Times, UN Bureau Chief. Usually he's in Cairo now. He had the front page story in the Sunday paper on the vacuum after Gaddafi, and he's the author of the book, The Media Relations Department of Hezbollah Wishes You a Happy Birthday, Unexpected Encounters in the Changing Middle East. And Neil, you predicted in your book that at some point Egypt would explode into riots. And I wonder, through your book research on reformers, did you see a serious movement taking shape to oust Mubarak, perhaps oust Gaddafi, oust these other dictators before the rest of the world suddenly started taking it seriously just a few weeks ago? Even the CIA seemed to be caught off guard. But you were talking to all these reformers 2, 3, 4 years ago.
I think that, you know, obviously nobody predicted the scope of this all. You know, when he lived in Egypt, there was just this anger bubbling beneath the surface, just the way the government tended to treat people. And the way, you know, you saw is in disasters, you know, government disasters. A ferry would sink and 1,100 people would drown and the government would not hold anybody accountable, or a train going across Egypt would catch fire and 300 people would burn to death and nobody would be held accountable. And there was just always angry scenes around that, and you just sort of sense this sort of undercurrent, you know, of rage and frustration in people, and obviously, you know, tied to economic problems too, the difficulty in finding jobs, the constant inflation, you know, the sense that, you know, a very small group of people were getting rich. But obviously, I mean, the other point that I make in that book is just, you know, the difficulty of overcoming these, you know, these police states, because everybody has incredible amounts of secret police that they use to enforce their rule in all these countries, even, you know, sort of so-called gentle monarchies like Jordan. There's a heavy hand of the secret police there. So it was always a question of how you overcome it. And I think the amazing thing that we're seeing all across the region is that fear has sort of been overcome by just, you know, this sort of national sentiment among people that they're all going to come out together and they're just not going to take it anymore. And, you know, Libya's kind of an amazing case, just because the government has been using violence against them and they're still coming out. So I don't think, you know, when I lived here, I always sensed that it was a possibility, but I never knew what the spark was going to be. And, you know, of course, we saw what happened in Tunis, and it just turned out that fruit seller igniting himself turned out to be the literal spark. And so that's what was difficult to predict.
Indeed, which means that kindling must have been there just ready to explode after somebody dared to light that spark. You grew up in Libya. Where in Libya, and for how much of your childhood?
It's funny, because I spent 10 years there, actually, and I grew up in a little oil town. It's sort of at the very bottom of the Gulf of Sirte, about a 2.5-hour drive west of Benghazi and probably a 7-hour drive further on to Tripoli. And, you know, I just, some of the British oil workers were trapped there, and I was just talking to one of our correspondents on the ground there, and that's sort of the no man's land now between the government forces and the opposition. And, you know, when I was there, it was sort of tranquil, not to say sleepy, little expatriate community that until Gaddafi's revolution, Libyans were not actually allowed to live there. They were allowed to work there, but they had to be out after 5 o'clock.
So now there's this real civil war taking place. Who are the rebels fighting against Gaddafi? We keep hearing that rebels in Libya control much of the country, but who are these rebels? Are they, you know, pro-democracy Google executives, or who are they?
Well, we're all trying to figure that out. But, of course, eastern Libya has never really been Gaddafi territory. There's always been strong elements of opposition to him there, and there's a configuration of tribes. And, you know, I just one little aside, whenever we start talking about tribes, the sort of intellectual class gets nervous and say, oh, you Westerners are always trying to put us into tribes, and nobody thinks about that anymore. But there, it is an organizational structure in all of these countries that sort of waxes and wanes according to the ideology. But in eastern Libya, the sort of confederation of tribes there is called the Saadi tribe, and the king came from them. And the king's sort of legitimacy was based on this tribe because it was the sort of there's a mystical form of Islam that is prevalent in Libya, a Sufi Islam, and the former king, King Idris, was the head of this tribe and therefore sort of the head of the sect. And as soon as Gaddafi came to power, they sort of lost their cachet or their and their control of the country. So someone said to me the other day, if there had been communist rebels in eastern Libya, they would have gotten support because everybody just hated Gaddafi so much. So you have that sort of basis there. In the 1990s, there were some assassination attempts against Gaddafi in eastern Libya carried out by some, you know, sort of jihadi types who had fought in Afghanistan, and they came home. So they were sort of centered in the east. And then you have some defections, some, you know, the Minister of Justice, the Minister of Interior, people like that who have decided that not to side with Gaddafi are over in the eastern part of the country. So it's an amalgamation, and it's very difficult to figure out sort of who is, you know, who's running what and how much they're all each other.
And so to the title and theme of your article on page one yesterday, the vacuum after Gaddafi. You know, the words earthquake and freedom got juxtaposed in a Libya interview on ABC yesterday. ABC This Week host Christian Amanpour was in Libya interviewing Gaddafi's son, Saadi, and they had this exchange. Listen.
What do you think is happening to your region?
Earthquake.
An earthquake?
An earthquake. It's a fever. It's going to spread everywhere. No one will stop it. This is my personal opinion. And the chaos will be everywhere.
You think it'll be chaos, or you think it'll be a fever of freedom and democracy?
No. They think it's about freedom. Everybody loves freedom. I love freedom. You love freedom. But it's much powerful, this earthquake. No one can control it.
Will your father leave?
I think it's, let's say if he has to leave today. If he leaves today, just 1 hour later, local war, civil war in Libya.
Neil McFarquhar in Cairo, what were you thinking listening to that exchange?
Well, you know, I mean, the Gaddafis are trying to have it both ways. I mean, the father, too, in his speeches, you know, and that was safe, his son. And they say, without us, you know, we're the only thing holding this country together. Without us, it's going to be civil war. Without us, it's going to be bloody. Well, of course, with them, it's going to be civil war, and it's going to be bloody. Because, you know, Gaddafi stood on the ramparts of that 16th century fort in Tripoli Harbor the other day and said, you know, I'm going to arm people, and it's going to be civil war. So basically, they're using whatever argument they can to try and hang on to power. And you know, we don't know the answer to that. I mean, in Libya, there is a chance just because Gaddafi destroyed every single institution. There's no army, there's no parliament, there's no civil society, there's no NGOs, there's barely any functioning ministry. So you don't know who's going to step in, and suddenly all these weapons caches have been opened. So, yes, there's a possibility of violence. And I think, you know, on the optimist side, they look at that sort of organization in Benghazi where they've got a sort of council going running the city, and they say, you know, people are stepping up to the plate, and they are able to, you know, effectively run the place, and others are saying, no, as soon as Gaddafi's gone, there's going to be a bloodbath trying to kill off anybody connected to the regime. So it is difficult to predict, but I think that the Democrats would argue that nobody could do a worse or more abusive or more violent job than these regimes have done over the past 40 years as they have just held on to power and refused to change.
Your article sketches various scenarios that are at various stages of alarming for the post-Gaddafi Libya, the worst being that Libya crumbles into a failed state that makes it vulnerable to becoming a haven for al-Qaeda. There's a front-page analysis in Today's Times by Scott Chain that says pretty unequivocally that this whole movement in the Middle East is leaving al-Qaeda in the dust. Arabs and Iranians are in the streets for democracy. Al-Qaeda didn't lead these uprisings, wasn't prepared for them, and has been rendered completely irrelevant, at least for now. How much do you agree with that analysis, and how much opportunity do you think is left for them, depending on how things turn out?
I mean, I think, you know, al-Qaeda has had this narrative all along about religion and, you know, sort of jihad and violence in the service of religion. And I think the appeal was limited to begin with, but people turned to it because there was absolutely no, you know, freedom of expression, no political parties, and there was no means to sort of voice their frustrations with living in such closed societies. And as soon as you open up the societies, that appeal, you know, disappears because people can voice their opinions, they can participate, and they feel like, you know, they have control over their own lives to a certain extent. But, you know, the grand caveat of that is all of these are works in progress. I mean, this has all been happening since, you know, January 14th when the president of Tunis fell. So we're barely 6 weeks into it, and the presidents have fallen, but the regimes have not. And, you know, if the army and the secret police, you know, in these countries just sort of reassert their old total control in a different form, then obviously that's going to create a whole new level of frustration, and maybe people will say that violence is the only solution. But if, on the other hand, the people pressure works and people keep the momentum up, then maybe we'll see something new in the Middle East.
Before you go, Neil, this must be amazing for you. After writing a whole book on reform movements in the Middle East, which most people didn't take seriously or think had a serious chance of coming to power or really bringing change, is it thrilling to watch?
It's just, it is thrilling to watch, but it's also just because, you know, I spent so much time covering bloodshed, and then I spent a year talking to reformers, and I just had unbelievable, profound respect and admiration because, you know, they would be arrested, and they would be beaten up, and they would be jailed, and, you know, some of that is still happening, but they just kept persevering in the face of terrible prosecution and terrible odds, really, because you just thought, you know, that there's so much stacked against them in terms of, you know, these military regimes, and the ubiquitous power of the secret police, and just you know, religious figures telling them that democracy was not something you could achieve in the Arab world. And, you know, I have to be sober about it. They haven't achieved it yet. But just to see this groundswell of people saying we want to be free is amazing.
Neil McFarquhar is author of the book The Media Relations Department of Hezbollah Wishes You a Happy Birthday, Unexpected Encounters in the Changing Middle East. He's also the New York Times UN bureau chief, has an article on the front page of yesterday's Times titled The Vacuum After Gaddafi, and he joined us today from Cairo. Neil, thank you so much.
Thank you. Anytime.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, a new formula for one of the toughest questions in medical ethics: who gets kidney transplants when there aren't enough to go around? And of course, we could ask the same question about other organs. But this new way would emphasize years of life to be saved. In other words, younger people tend to get them, rather than who's been waiting the longest. We'll talk about it in a minute.